Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Richard Salver, who was born in Cleveland, Ohio, and while in his teens he became interested in yoga philosophy and the teachings of reincarnation. He got his first job in order to earn money to visit a yoga community in California called Ananda. And 2 years later, Richard moved to Ananda Village, and he has been part of Ananda ever since and incorporates 30 years of meditation and study and practice of the deeper teachings of yoga into his talks and writings. I will say hello to Richard. Are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you, Mike?
Very well, thank you. Yes, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We'll get cracking straight away. What I would like to ask you before we get involved into your very interesting book, it's a little bit about your years living as a monk in the yoga community's monastery. And as part of explaining that to us, I would like to know what a typical day would mean in terms of what you did.
Well, it was really quite a wonderful experience. At that time, our monastery was just in its early stages of being formed, so we lived a very rustic lifestyle. I woke up in the early morning hours in a teepee on a hill in the Sierra Nevada foothills, and I would get up early and spend several hours in meditation, practicing meditation techniques and just listening in the inner silence. And then I would hike over the hill, and I would go to work at a dairy that we had there and milk the cows, and then work in the kitchen there, running the kitchen and so on, and do the morning chores and so on. And then we would do the evening chores, and then we'd hike back up over the hill and join the other monks for a group meditation, and then just some quiet time before bed. But that was a typical day in my life in those days. I still hearken back to it, and some days I really miss it. It was very simple back then.
Yes. So how long was a typical day? I mean, did it go right into the evening?
Yes. Yeah, so some days were like that. Some days you would be scheduled for evening chores, and other days you weren't. If you were, it might go, you know, fairly late into the evening. Typically, I would end up sleeping about 6 hours a night or so, and I still do about that much.
Oh, you do, yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess because of that, you automatically find yourself waking up extremely early in the morning.
Yes, that's right.
Now, you were sent out, apparently, to start up other communities in Northern California and Italy. Did you have a lot of success with that?
Yes. We were able to start communities in many parts, parts of America and also in Italy. The one in Italy ended up being centered right near Assisi, where St. Francis is from, which is a very powerful spiritual place. And if you go there, you could also check on the internet before you visit Assisi about the Ananda community, which is about 20 to 30 minutes outside of Assisi. But we also have communities in Sacramento and here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and it's been my pleasure to be able to help those communities form and come together.
Right. Now, you said that you meditated for several hours. What is the purpose of the type of meditation that you do?
Well, I practice something that's called Kriya Yoga, and this is a meditation technique that Paramahansa Yogananda wrote about in his spiritual classic, The Autobiography of a Yogi. Many people have seen Yogananda's photo because it was on the Sgt. Pepper album, and his writings have influenced the Beatles and Elvis Presley and many millions throughout the world. But he wrote about this technique called Kriya Yoga, which is a technique that helps to hasten spiritual evolution. It helps to align the energies in the deepest part of our being so that we can more easily go into a deep state of meditation. And I found this technique to be just wonderful to help me to go and dive deep into meditation.
Yes. I guess the one that I use, which is simply visual relaxation exercise. I sort of run from the top of my head down to my toes, as it were, to put myself into a relaxed mood. It's probably somewhat different to what you do yourself.
Yes, but every technique seems to be one that helps us to withdraw the mind from the periphery of our being and into our deeper self.
Yeah. Does Yogananda commit himself to any particular type of spiritual teaching?
Well, what he taught, his teaching he called self-realization, which is the way that he described it was that it was a combination of the original Christianity as taught by Christ and the original yoga as taught by Krishna. And we're talking here, when we're talking about yoga, we're not talking about yoga postures, but the deeper teachings of yoga, Patanjali's Eightfold Path of Yoga, which is a spiritual, deep, very deep and profound spiritual path. It's like a scientific approach to spirituality and self-realization.
Yeah. Right. Okay, we'll move on a little bit from that now. Now we've established what is behind the man who wrote the book called, where are we? Soul Journey from Lincoln to Lindbergh.
Yes.
Now, you obviously would like to tell us what inspired you to write that, and perhaps you could give us some of the details. Mm-hmm. And I see that you spent many years researching material for the book. Perhaps you'd like to tell us all about that.
Yes, yes. About 10 years ago or so, I had come to a point where for the past 5 years before that, I'd been having experiences in meditation and otherwise related to reincarnation, past lives, karma, healing of past lives, different things like that, practically on a daily basis. In fact, one of the most powerful experiences I had during that time period related to a visit that I had when I came to England and started visiting places, and it seemed like everywhere I went, it was familiar to me, and it was obvious that I'd been there in the past life, including a battlefield or places like that. But anyway, so I'd been receiving this information in meditation. This was really helpful to me spiritually, very inspiring and healing. And I was searching for a way to be able to share that information. And I found myself, I'm a writer, I found myself in between writing projects. And I was flying to the East Coast about 10 years ago here in the States, and I just decided, because I'm a spiritual person and a minister, that I would just open myself up to the universe and just ask for guidance from God. And so I did that. I said a prayer and asking for guidance, and within less than a minute's time, the idea for this book came to me. And it wasn't a vague notion. It was a very powerful thought. And if I could put it into words, it would be, what you had read years ago about what Yogananda had said about Abraham Lincoln and his past lives, why don't you investigate that? And what Yogananda had said, according to his disciple Kriyananda, which is written in Kriyananda's autobiography, The Path, in a title called Reincarnation, was that Yogananda said that Abraham Lincoln, in a past life, had been an advanced Himalayan yogi, and also that he was reborn in the 20th century as Charles Lindbergh. And so while I was sitting on that airplane, the idea just came to me, I should research those lives. Now, at that point, I'd been practicing and studying and teaching the deeper teachings of yoga for about 20 years or more, so I knew that if there were evidence in those two lifetimes related to or a sense that they had known these teachings of yoga in the past, I would be able to spot them. But I also recognized that here were two men whose lives were so deeply chronicled. The historians had gone into little bitty details related to everything that had to do with their lives, that if there was evidence that what Yogananda had said was true, if there were connections between the two men, that it should be possible. Very easy to spot them. And so I started working on this project, and I'll tell you, especially at the very beginning, it just took over my life. I ate, drank, slept, meditated, Lincoln Lindbergh in a past life, Himalayan yogi. And I was just overwhelmed by both the quality and the quantity of the connections that I found. I ended up discovering, you know, at the beginning I thought I might find a few interesting connections. I didn't know what I'd find.
Yeah.
But, you know, after working on these for a number of years, I ended up uncovering nearly 500 fascinating similarities between the lives of Lincoln and Lindbergh. More than 200 between Abraham Lincoln and the practice of yoga, and more than 100 between Charles Lindbergh and the science of yoga.
That's amazing, yes.
Yeah, isn't it?
If I may ask you a question, Richard, at that point, was one of the first ones you found related in any way to their date of birth?
Connections between their dates of birth?
Yes.
You mean like an astrological connection? It's interesting that Lindbergh was born in the same month as Lincoln. Lincoln was born on February 2nd, I believe, and I think that Lindbergh was about 10 or 12 days after that. So to some degree, you know, there's some similarities that everyone has who has the same astrological sign. But the similarities, you know, the similarities I found between the two men, they're not the sort of similarities that everybody has. You know, they like pizza or the Beatles music or something like that, but more like mental obsessions, social habits, physical habits, you know, just everything that defines an individual, everything that you say, okay, we know that that's so-and-so because he always does this. You know, you can pretty much find a connection between Lincoln and Lindbergh.
Right. Did you visit any places that were made famous by their association with Lincoln or Lindbergh?
Well, I think both men were famous to begin with. You know, their lives are famous.
Yes.
And I think one way that you could say that what you're saying is true is just the question of why Lincoln would reincarnate as Lindbergh. And that's related to, to understand that we just have to look at the end of Abraham Lincoln's life. His whole lifetime was pretty much laid out for him at a young age. He had visions when he was a young boy that he would rise to a place of power, and then he would fall from that place of power in a bloody ending. And he knew that that was going to happen, and so his lifetime was very sort of, he didn't have a lot of leeway in as far as what he was going to do. He really had a life mission that he had to accomplish. And he accomplished that mission. He held the United States together during the Civil War. He freed the slaves, and he did many other wonderful things in that lifetime.
Yeah.
And right at the end of his great work, within about a week's time of Robert E. Lee's signing of the Treaty at Appomattox, when the war was just about over, then he was assassinated. He was shot and killed. And so he was taken away from that lifetime. And if you understand reincarnation, you know it has a very important corollary to it, which is the law of karma. And the law of karma literally means action. And it's the principle of action and reaction, of cause and effect. For as Newton said in his third law of emotion, for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. And this law, which you see in the physical universe, also pervades the subtle universe. Whatever we put out comes back to us, good, bad, or indifferent. And it's a teaching tool. There's no desire to punish. It's just there to help us to learn our lessons in life. And for Abraham Lincoln, if you look at the end of his life, you know, he left that lifetime with what I call a huge payment due stamped on his forehead. He had done so many wonderful things. He had helped so many people. And then right at the end of that great work, his life was snuffed out and he was taken away. So he just there was this huge pendulum swing pushed outward of good karma that needed to be reaped, that needed to be gathered in. And you see in the life of Charles Lindbergh that he harvested this huge, big karma. At a very young age, he was 25 years old when he flew the Atlantic. Now, many people don't realize that many other people had flown the Atlantic before Lindbergh, but he became real famous. None of them the others are remembered. A couple of men flew even farther than he had about a week later, and they were ignored. But what Charles Lindbergh did was just heralded by everybody as this great feat, and it, it was a great feat, and it does deserve to be honored, but the emotional reaction, if you read the history of Lindbergh, it's just incredible, the way that people just, they just totally fell in love with him. They would see him and they would burst into tears. And they would, you know, it just completely out of balance with what he had done. The equation isn't 5 plus 5 equaling 10. It's 5 plus 5 equaling 10 million. Just to give you an example, again, of the emotion, the way that people reacted to emotion, they just went crazy over him. They just loved him. He was in a parade going down Broadway in Manhattan, and the whole street was covered with people, and people in the windows were dropping confetti and so on. And, people were also crowded onto the side streets branching off from Broadway, and they couldn't even see Lindbergh going by, but they heard that he was going by because of the noise, you know, the acclaim. And some of those people were weeping. They weren't even seeing him. This doesn't make any sense.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense, but it does make sense if this was Abraham Lincoln reborn.
Yes, yes. Now, I mentioned about any link astrologically when both of these incarnations took place. Was there any link at all in the manner of which they passed on? I can't recall how Charles Lindbergh died, whether it was a natural death or otherwise.
Yes, you know, there isn't any similarity there. Lindbergh was not assassinated. But, you know, it would be surprising for somebody who had lived such a good life as Lincoln did. Somehow Lincoln had the karma to be assassinated. Or maybe to some degree he was taking on the karma of the country, because when you have that position of being a leader of a country, sometimes you end up taking for a period of time some of the karma of that country as part of the burden, which is why so many of these people really age in office. You know, it's not only how intense their job is, but there is a psychic burden there, a spiritual burden as well.
Yeah.
And but for Lindbergh, he died of a form of cancer when he was about in his mid-70s. Lincoln, of course, was assassinated was in the mid-50s, so there's no direct correlation there. But it's really quite interesting. Before Lindbergh died, he knew that he was going to pass on. And so he did several things. First thing was that his approach to his dying was very much in tune with the Himalayan yogis. He just studied his body and watched it just sort of falling apart. And it was, to him, it was just an interesting experiment. Now, this is the same sort of detachment that a yogi learns when he learns to meditate, or when he learns to practice the yoga postures, even from a very deep level. Just watch the body and go through its changes. And he did that automatically without thinking about it. The second thing that he did was that he determined to kind of stage his own burial and his funeral and everything like that. And he was very, again, not very non-attached about it, just as a yogi would be. And he found an old chapel on the island of Maui in Hawaii. And this chapel was very interesting. It was built in the 1860s, right in the last years of Abraham Lincoln's life. And it had kind of fallen into a little bit of ruin, and Lindbergh had put the energy out to kind of fix it up and make it nice again. And he asked to be buried next to the chapel that was built around the time that the Lincoln's last years, which is rather interesting. You see a lot of these sort of little connections here and there throughout their lives. They're just sort of woven between the two lifetimes. It's really a fascinating study.
Absolutely, yes. But while you were doing all this research for the book, did you have any particularly unusual happenings, say, such as any psychic experiences?
Well, I had several. One had to do with the fact that at one point I decided I just wanted to visit where Abraham Lincoln had lived. Yogananda said that he was an advanced spiritual soul, and as somebody who had meditated for 25, 30 years at that point, I had gone to places where advanced souls had been, like Assisi, and had felt the vibrations. Each place is inspiring for different saints, but they were also inspiring in different ways, and there's sort of like a spiritual signature at each location.
Wow.
And so I went to Abraham Lincoln sites, and I really did feel a light coming through that lifetime. He really was an advanced soul, like Yogananda had said. It was very plain to me because I had taken a red-eye flight to get there, and I hadn't had any sleep the night before. So when I got there, I was very sleepy, but just the energy of the place really woke me up and kept me awake. So it was very clear and very powerful. And so one day I went through the Lincoln sites and just enjoyed them tremendously, especially in his law office. It's very powerful there in Springfield, Illinois. The next day I caught an early flight to Minnesota and drove up to central Minnesota, a little town called Little Falls, where Charles Lindbergh had lived as a young boy. And in that place, there's a little house there with some land around it, right near the source of the Mississippi. And as soon as I set foot on the property of his home, my knees almost buckled because I felt the exact same energy I'd felt the day before at the Lincoln sites. But there was one difference. You know, Lincoln is known throughout his lifetime for having a certain melancholy. You could see it in some of his photographs. And I felt that at the Lincoln sites. And it didn't diminish the light that came through. And the way I describe it is that it's like a pinch of spice thrown into a soup to bring out the flavor. And but it was still noticeable. But when I went to the Lindbergh site, immediately what I felt was the same light that was in Lincoln, but the sadness was gone. And the way that I could understand that was that through all of his selfless acts in his lifetime, that Abraham Lincoln has freed himself from that sadness, whatever the cause of that might have been in the deep reaches of the past. So that was one psychic experience I had, but just very briefly, another one I had, especially at the beginning of working on the project, but it carried on, was that I would be reading about Abraham Lincoln from one of his the history books and biographies, people who knew him and so on. And I would read something, and it would make me wonder about Charles Lindbergh, where there was a connection. And the day after I read that, I would be in a bookstore or a library, and I would see a book, and something would compel me to take it off the shelf and open it. And right on the page I would open it to would be the answer to my question. And now, that didn't just happen once, but it happened over and over again. It's a very strong feeling of guidance when working on this book.
I had a friend who had a similar experience. She walked into a bookshop, and the book fell off the shelf virtually into her hand.
Yes.
And she realized it was one that she needed. So,
yes,
some strange things happen like that.
Yes. I think if we're really meant to find something, that we will find it, you know, especially if we really want something deeply inside. We're really asking the question, and we're open to receiving the answer. It can come
absolutely
in a physical way, or it can just come as an idea, as an inspiration.
Yes, I totally believe that. Mm. Now, what connections did you find from, say, their different family sort of trees? I mean, did they both marry? Did they both have children? And, in fact, one might ask, did they, in fact, marry the same woman?
Yes, someone might ask that. It's a good question just for all of us. You know, do we end up marrying the same person if reincarnation is true? Do we carry those relationships forward? It's interesting. Well, you know, just looking at the family, starting with that, Abraham Lincoln had four boys as children in his family, and several of them died. One died while he was in the middle of the public eye when he was president, when his favorite son, Willie, died of typhoid, which is a great tragedy for him. Charles Lindbergh also had four boys plus two girls. And it's interesting that Lincoln, toward the end of his life, wished that he could have had a girl also. I wish he could have had a daughter and never had one. And Lindbergh, in his life, that desire was fulfilled. But also for Lindbergh, just like with Lincoln, when he was in the middle of the public eye, after he had flown the Atlantic, and every time he did anything, he sneezed, be on the front page. He lost his son too. His son was killed during a kidnapping attempt, the famous Lindbergh kidnapping. Yeah. And historians pretty much agree that it was an accident happening during the time of the kidnapping. But still, to lose a son while you're in the middle of the public eye, that's a a very unusual test. Not everybody has it in their lifetime. Unusual trial and tribulation of the spirit, but they both men had that.
Yeah.
And then you were asking about the wives also.
Yes.
And that's a very interesting thing. You know, I was just starting to look into those connections when a friend of mine who had also studied this to some degree, he said, you know, when I was looking at it, it didn't seem that the Mary Todd Lincoln and Anne Marl Lindbergh could have been the same person because their personalities are so different. But this, my friend John Downey, he gave me the idea also. He said, but I was wondering about Anne Marl Lindbergh, whether her connection with Anne Rutledge. Now, for those who don't know, the legend of Abraham Lincoln goes that when he was a young man, he was living in a small town called New Salem, which is just outside of Springfield in Illinois.
Yes.
And it was like a frontier town, like about 5 years after Lincoln left it, it had disappeared. It was one of those places that arise for a few years and then just disappear. And when he was there, he was staying in a place called the Rutledge Tavern that was run by Anne Rutledge's father. And he met Anne, and she was a young woman, and they fell in love, eventually got engaged. But before their relationship could be consummated, she got sick and died. Yes, and in fact, Lincoln's law partner, William Herndon, wrote that this was the cause of Lincoln's lifelong melancholy, that to this woman that he was felt so connected with, that she was really his soulmate on a very deep level, really just gave him this sadness throughout his life. And so, you know, and it's interesting that it's not just the connection between the two names, Anne Rutledge and Marl Lindbergh, but the fact that the two young women, the information that we do have on Anne Rutledge, you see the personality is really the same as Anne Marl. My friend was perfectly correct. And so it gives hope to us all because many of us, you know, we lose somebody, you know, for some reason or another. Stories of star-crossed lovers, you know, throughout the ages, you know, and the one that got away and all that stuff. Will we ever be able to consummate that? Well, according to reincarnation, this particular example, we can, we do. We will find each other again in a future lifetime to be able to pursue that relationship.
So what does your book have to say about Lindbergh's mystical experiences during his historic flight to Paris? Does that connect with the deeper teachings of yoga?
Yes, that's really quite fascinating. Most of us know and were taught in school about Lindbergh's flight, how he did the solo flight from New York to Paris in 1927. But what most of us don't know is that he had these mystical experiences during that flight. Just to give it in a nutshell, the night before he made his flight, Charles Lindbergh was so excited and busy making preparations to leave that he pretty much had no sleep that night. And then for the flight itself, you know, he made the flight all on his own. The flight itself lasted 33 and a half hours.
Oh, gosh.
So, you know, if you take all that into account, we're talking about 60 hours of being up without any sleep. So,
amazing.
Yeah. Now, this is something that Himalayan yogis do sometimes. They'll go without sleep for nights in a row. They'll just be so deep in meditation that they won't need sleep. But for Lindbergh, he wasn't practicing any meditation techniques, but he was out over the Atlantic about halfway across. And he was in the middle of the night, and again, he'd had pretty much no sleep at all the night before. And there comes a time when you try to stay up all night, and I've experienced this, where it just takes all your effort to keep your eyelids open. There's just a very deep pull to want to fall asleep, especially right in the middle of the night, before the early morning hours. It's just really hard to stay awake. And Lindbergh was experiencing this, and there was this tug of war going on between his conscious mind and his subconscious. And his subconscious was whispering to him, "Oh, you got to fall asleep. Nobody can stay up like this. It's just inhuman. It's just not possible." And his conscious mind would argue back, "No. If I fall asleep, I'll just dive right into the ocean, and nobody will hear from me again."
extent.
And so this struggle is going on, and the tension between the conscious and the subconscious catapulted Lindbergh into a superconscious state. Yogananda said that the superconscious mind, the higher consciousness, is accessed at the horizon line between the conscious and the subconscious. And
yeah.
This is what happened to Lindbergh. In his book, The Spirit of St. Louis, in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, he said that a third part of his mind started to speak to him at this point. And it said, you're going to rest, don't worry, but you won't fall asleep, and everything will be fine. And he was too tired to argue this unlikely counsel, and he just sort of surrendered and gave in. And suddenly, he started to have all these experiences at once. The first thing that he noticed was that he could see all around himself, 360 degrees at one time. As if he said the back of his head was one big eyeball. It's like, it's something that is a very rare experience that yogis sometimes have in meditation called spherical vision.
Yeah.
And so he was experiencing that. At the same time, he noticed that the cockpit of his airplane was starting to fill up, that there were these spirits that were coming to him and visiting him. And these spirits sort of invaded the spirit of St. Louis. And he said they would come in and come forward one at a time and speak to him, mind to mind and spirit to spirit. He said he could never remember exactly what they said, but it was deeply meaningful to him, and he always wished that he could remember. He also wrote in that book that even though these all seemed so familiar, these spirits, but he couldn't remember where he had seen them before, and he started to wonder whether he had known them in some past life, he said.
Right.
And so we can wonder whether these were fellow Himalayan yogis, fellow advanced yogis, old friends from past lives, spiritual friends who came to visit Lindbergh at this very important moment in his life to give him support and counsel. But anyway, so he had this experience for a while, and it was very, very beautiful, and he was really kind of half in the physical world and half in the astral plane. And after a while, these souls disappeared, and then something else happened. His spiritual self, his astral body, disconnected from his physical body and went out through the cone of his airplane, mixed, as he wrote it, with the wash from his propeller, and then soared in the air, flew in the air next to the spirit of St. Louis over the Atlantic. So at this point, Lucky Lindy was flying two planes at once, the spirit of St. Louis and the astral plane. Now, there's one little addendum at the end of this story, which is really quite fascinating. All the time this is happening, his physical body was continuing to fly this airplane.
Yeah.
And it was like it was on autopilot, his body was. And just doing it, just out of habit or whatever you might say, maybe the superconscious mind was directing his physical body, but it was beyond his conscious knowledge of it. And the thing about that flight, you know, is that at times during that flight, his compass wasn't working. He several times had to go up and down through clouds, and several times he wasn't sure exactly which direction he was flying. And after all of these experiences, including these spiritual ones where he wasn't even in control of the flight, when he finally made landfall in Great Britain on the Irish coast, he found that he was pretty much exactly on his course, which is just, the odds are just astronomically against that.
Mm,
it's amazing.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Right. Now, in view of the fact that you've indicated that Lindbergh was psychic to some degree and evidently believed in reincarnation, did he give any clue as to whether he suspected he might have been someone like Abraham Lincoln before?
Mm. You know, you don't see that written out anywhere. That's something that I did search for. You see little moments where you wonder whether he might have known and just would say, give little hints here and there. But, you know, he had achieved so much notoriety in his life, there was no need to add to it. And as being an advanced soul, too, it wasn't something that he might brag about to anyone. However, there's a few interesting little details, such as the fact that after he made his flight and he returned to the United States, everybody in America wanted him to come see them. And so they all gave him invitations, and he made tour of cross-country tour of the continental United States, where he either landed or flew over all the states in the Union and the continental United States. And one place he stopped was in Abraham Lincoln's old hometown of Springfield. And when he was there, the reporters, when he got out of his airplane, stepped out of his airplane, the reporters asked him, well, what is it like for you to visit Springfield? And Lindbergh said, it's just like coming home.
Yeah.
And that was Lincoln's hometown.
And that seems to indicate that he really was connected with Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
Did he, in that event, ever show any feeling that he might have been someone of the importance of the president?
Yes, well, you know, this is the sort of thing that we carry with us from one lifetime to the next. There's that saying that you can't take it with you, you know, when you leave your physical body, usually related to, you know, worldly wealth and things like that. Although there's a story of a rich man who went to a psychic to try to find out who he would be in his next lifetime so that he could will his money to himself.
Yeah.
You can't really take it with you that way. But what we do carry with us are the lessons that we've learned in life, especially the positive lessons, the good things that we've learned. But we also tend to carry with us the baggage of habits. You know, we're just used to doing things a certain way. When you become the head of a country, a prime minister or a president, you become used to thinking in national terms. And when you read Lindbergh's writings, you see that he does have that perspective. He does think in terms of nationally, internationally, globally. He often wrote about the United States saying, my country, my United States, our United States. It was almost like a fireside chat. It really had the vibration. It had the terminology that a president would use when saying, my fellow Americans, and so on. It just had that feeling to it. And you see that he would just talk to other people as someone representing America. After his famous flight, he would go to other countries, and he became a sort of unofficial goodwill ambassador from America to the rest of the world. And he just very naturally assumed this role and, in fact, tried to further it in any way possible to help to have a positive relations with the rest of the world. And, you know, Lincoln died when he was still in office, but if he had lived for another 20 years, and if he had been able to visit other parts of the world that Lindbergh was able to visit in his life, so you see that desire being fulfilled, he might very well have taken on a similar role, being wined and dined, offices of state, you know, things like that. These are things that Lindbergh did. Everybody wanted to honor him, so he met presidents and he met prime ministers, and he was given parades, and a great president might have similar experiences.
Yes, indeed. Incidentally, I can vouch for something where you were talking about Lindbergh's psychic experiences being out of the body while on that trip to Paris. I had a friend who knew a person who was driving his vehicle on a long straight road to the coast, and he suddenly found himself way up above the vehicle, which he could see below him, and he was aware that he was both above it and obviously still inside it driving it.
There's
very much a parallel there.
Yes, sometimes people too, I've heard it said that when people are about to get involved in an accident, sometimes they'll be popped out of their bodies, and they're still driving it for, you know, a short period of time before the accident happens, but they didn't have the karma to have to really be in the body that deeply to experience the accident itself. You know, sometimes our souls will pop us out for one reason or another. The deepest part of who and what we are is very wise, understands things on a much deeper level than our conscious mind.
You said that Yogananda spoke about Lincoln having been an advanced Himalayan yogi in a past life. And with all your research, I think you've touched upon it at least once so far. Were the signs in each of their lives that they were aware of it or were doing things quite automatically that were in their subconscious?
Yes, I think it was more just habit. Just to give you one example, somebody who meditates for several hours every day, when you go into a deep state of meditation, and this is something that yogis teach and practice, when you go into a superconscious state, something that happens automatically is that your upper eyelids will lower themselves, and your lower eyelids will come up a little bit, so that you have a half-closed look in your eyes. And when you look at, it's very interesting, when you look at the photographs of Abraham Lincoln, quite a number of them have this half-closed look. And one of the reasons why that is so is that in his day, photography was in its infancy. This was in, you know, his first photographs were like in the 1840s or something like that, all the way through 1865. Photography was just getting going. And they couldn't just take these snapshots. When you went to get your photograph taken, often they would strap you into this device that would hold you perfectly still. And so you had to sit there for like several minutes at a time. Now, if in a past life you had lived as a Himalayan yogi and spent years of daily long meditations where you just got in the habit whenever you sat still, after a while, your eyes would slowly half close. And what happened with Lincoln is he would sit in this contraption after, you know, a while. Some of the photographs you could see that he just looked bored. But some of them he'd have this half closed look where, you know, his breath would slow down, his mind would calm down, and then his upper eyelid just automatically would just come down to a half-closed look, which is just really quite fascinating. You know, as a yogi, I looked at those photographs, and I say, this is just amazing. And once I read the history and knew about photography in those days, it all made perfect sense. But this is just one of, again, hundreds of yoga connections with the teachings of yoga in Lincoln's lifetime.
Well, certainly the average person wouldn't be aware of that aspect, so that's a very interesting point you've brought out there.
Yeah.
Did you gather any evidence as to why Lincoln, say, would have reincarnated as Lindbergh? Was there a connection karmically? I mean, you said that Abraham Lincoln obviously got over that melancholy, and that showed in Lindbergh's life because he didn't carry that forward. But was there any other aspects that would lead to that conclusion?
Yes. I mentioned, too, how there was a payment due stamped on Lincoln's forehead when he left his body, just needing to reap the rewards of his lifetime, and he did as Lindbergh. But there's another aspect to it, which I just sort of mentioned on the fly, which I can talk a little bit more about, which is the fact that Abraham Lincoln's life was so impersonal. When you come into a lifetime, when you have this sense of a life mission, there's very little leeway there to be able to just sort of do whatever you want to do when you feel like doing it. For Lincoln's life, and you study it, you see that even when he was first starting off as a lawyer, there were times when he would be tempted, or somebody would say, well, why don't you just cut a corner here or there, and he would say, no, if I do that, somebody could bring that up later on down the road. And this is before he was really diving into politics. You know, he just had this sense that he had to live a certain way, do things a certain way, so that he could fulfill his destiny, that he could achieve what he was meant to achieve in that lifetime. And so there's very little leeway there. There's very little freedom in that. And, you know, Lincoln was somebody who loved to travel. He would do something called the circuit court, which is he would ride this court circuit that went in counties adjacent to the county that Springfield is in, and he'd go out to the rural areas of that state and help the people with their legal problems and so on, argue cases and be a judge sometimes and be a lawyer other times and so on. And he did that not only the regular circuit court time period, but he extended it beyond that. He just loved that lifestyle of just being on the road and just helping people, which is a traditional lifestyle for a Himalayan yogi, who is a tradition of the wandering sadhu, just no place is his home, the whole world is his home. He goes around and helps everyone, gives love to everyone, and is just, yes. Yes, he's just, yeah, and, but for Lindbergh, you know, he got to fulfill that desire of Abraham Lincoln's to travel throughout his life. You know, you see, his whole life was just one big trip around the world. It was quite amazing.
Yes. I can see what you mean there. Now, in your book, apparently, you use the expression, I believe, or description of it, as offering a vicarious experience of reincarnation. Now, what does that mean?
Well, you know, many people who have read my book have told me that while reading of these many connections between Lincoln and Lindbergh, it was very easy for them to see their own past life connections in their own lives. And the reason for that is the way that I wrote the book. I didn't write it in a way that is very sort of like a historical treatise, which is actually the first way I wrote it. I ended up rewriting it. It's told in a story format. You'll have a little anecdote, say, from the life of Abraham Lincoln, and then right following it, you'll have a little anecdote from the life of Lindbergh. And while reading these two little stories, you see the connection or connections between them, between these life episodes. And while you read those over and over again, and there's some 340 pages in the book, and every page has like one or two of these at least, after reading so many of them, you start to see the ways in which reincarnation works in our own lives, the ways in which the law of karma functions. And each person, as we read it, we start to hearken back to moments in our lives when I say, oh, you know, I remember going to that place and just feeling like I'd been there before, or meeting this person and feeling like I'd known them forever, or, you know, just having this sense that, oh, I'd done this and then it came back to me. And just really starting to see how karma and reincarnation function in our lives. You know, we spend a lot of time and effort to understand our childhood because we know that what happened when we were young, often it's very formative and helps to create who we are today. And but if that's true just from our childhood in one lifetime, what about the childhoods of hundreds of lifetimes or the whole lifetime, you know, hundreds of lifetimes? How much more has that formed us? So this is a very helpful thing. If it affects us, we need to understand how it all works. And this book helps to do that, teach that.
It would seem to me quite clear that your book is proof of reincarnation. Would you put it forward as such?
I'd say that the soul journey from Lincoln to Lindbergh comes really close. Because from my perspective, I would say that it wouldn't be really possible to have final, definitive, categorical conclusive proof for everyone of a spiritual reality in the physical world, because the spiritual world transcends the physical. It makes use of the physical world, and you can see hints of it. You can see evidence of its workings in the physical world, but it can never really be defined by the physical world. However, as we mentioned earlier, you know, nearly 500 connections between Lincoln and Lindbergh, a statement by a great master of yoga who, if anyone should know, if there's a definite reincarnation case, someone like that would know. I think, and it's all in the history books. You know, you can look it all up, read it. I didn't make up this stuff, folks. It's all there. You know, all of us can read it. So it's just, I think it really does come close.
Yeah. Now, in view of what you found out there and your experience and spiritual growth, no doubt, through the meditations you've carried out, do you feel that the orthodox approach to life and death, possibly through orthodox religions, has prevented people from understanding the truth about life after death?
Well, I think there are aspects of the truth that come through many of these teachings, but they're presented, I think they're not perfectly clear in what happens, but enough of it comes through that we're able to, people, especially if they're wise, are able to tune into it and understand it. You see, even just teachings having to do with karma and reincarnation in the Bible, it's possible to find them there. The fact that Jesus, when his disciples were saying, well, John the Baptist was supposed to be here before you, who is that? And then he would talk about Elijah was supposed to come, and he said, well, that was, they knew that he was talking about John the Baptist, and in the Bible it says, let he who hath ears to hear, let him hear. You know, it's like, you know, they just sort of present these things on the sly, you know, and the law of karma in the New Testament, St. Paul said that you reap what you sow, you know, so it's in there, you know, and people tune into it to some degree, not to the degree that people who have it really just sort of spelled out for them can tune into it. But, you know, also, I just want to make this point. I believe, you know, I've seen there are great souls that have come through every religion, every religious tradition, every spiritual tradition. And whatever the limitations may be of the teachings, and no doubt, you know, every teaching has its own limitation, even if it's just a limitation of the time period, because when a great soul comes to this planet, there's a particular need at that time that they have to address. And so they're going to talk about certain aspects of the overall deep teachings that all the great souls talk about, but not others. And so those, that is a limitation in and of itself. But still, in spite of that, you know, or because of it, because somebody needs to particularly tune into those particular aspects of truth, you see these great souls arising. So it doesn't seem like it's absolutely necessary for every teaching to everything advanced, everything really pronounced that way. You know, you could follow a teaching as long as it's a true teaching, even if it doesn't cover everything. You can go as far, very far, or even all the way. You know, it just depends on the spirit of the person practicing it.
Yes, I agree with you. Do you see the coming years as leading to the end of this cycle, as many people do, including myself?
To a particular, like, world cycle?
It is said by some that we are at the end of a solar cycle where there will be an event or a process such as ascension. I just wondered whether that ever came into your mind or is within your spiritual beliefs.
You know, I think the thing that I have that at all seems to relate to that has to do with the Yuga cycle, which is described in the ancient teachings of India, something that Yogananda's guru, Sri Yukteswar, wrote about. He said that right now we are actually sort of in the death throes of the age of matter. It's called Kali Yuga, that we've been in this sort of like a bridge between Kali Yuga and the next age, which is called Dwapara Yuga, which is really where we're at now, that we're just at the beginning of one cycle, the end of another, and that there's a lot of changes and tumult that happens in the world when these sort of great cycles end and begin again. And you can see that in the world, just the changes that have happened in the world in the last 100 to 200 years, how everything has sped up so quickly. We've entered an age of energy. And right around the time when Ben Franklin was finding out about electricity and sharing that with the world, we were just starting that process, and now we're coming to the end of this middle time between the two ages. And so it's really a time of a birth, you know, a time where we're coming into a new time. At least this is a belief that I have and others have who followed the teachings that Yogananda taught. But it's interesting that you've tuned into something similar to that, sounds like. Hello? Hello? Is anyone there?